All right, welcome to Bet the Edge. I'm Jay Croucher here with the returning Drew Dinsick. It's been a while, Drew, since I've seen your luscious long locks and heard that supple voice of yours returning now from the slopes of my old stomping grounds, Colorado, though you got a lot more work done on the slopes than I did, as I was saying before we started recording. I kept on having new children while I was living in Colorado, so not super conducive with newborns hitting the slopes. But how was it overall?
It was incredible. Aspen is as good as advertised. The beer flowed like wine, exactly like they said. The women flocked like the salmon of Capistrano. It was extremely, extremely fun. Just a great resort town, expensive beyond belief. But if you set that part of it aside, if you're paying for a skiing resort experience, you cannot do better than that. The variety of the different skiing opportunities at all the different mountains was incredible. And just overall, the dining, the food, everything was just five stars. I am still blown away. I thought I had experienced the best of Western resort skiing, but now I know it is in Aspen.
There you go. Yeah, I think the thing with Denver, if you're living in Denver, as I was for a while, Denver, the city itself isn't, I don't think, that special. It's a good, fine city, and a lot of people, it's interesting because just a lot of people move from all over America to Denver. And so it just feels like everyone there is 38 years old and a Radiohead fan that has one kid or something. It's kind of that type of vibe. But
yeah,
downtown Denver is not great. But the thing is that places like Vail and Aspen are so close. And I was living close to New York, moved to Denver, and it was it's obviously not the same cultural experience as living in New York City, but there was something. The redeeming feature, obviously, is that you're just walking down the streets, you look out of the mountains, and then you go to the mountains, you go to Vail or Aspen, and there's German people and Italians and Argentinians. It's right, well, downtown Denver's not much, but an hour, two, 3 hours away, there's people coming from all over the world to check out these mountains. Yeah. Anyway. We're going to talk about the Denver Nuggets at some point in the pod. We're going to talk about the Central and Southeast divisions in the NBA, all NBA today. We'll talk about the West one seed, and then we will do our weekly or bi-weekly check-in on the MVP race, which continues to move. But let's start off with the Central division, Drew, which for a lot of the season just looked like it was done, looked like the Bucks would run away with it even though they weren't playing well. Then it looked like it was done the other way, where the Cavs got into minus 500 or so, I want to say, when they were on their incredible run and the Bucks were scuffling and entering games on Sunday. And this is going to flip given that the Cavs have blown this game to the Nets and the Bucks pulled one out against the Clippers. But this is basically pick entering Sunday, so we'll see the Bucks. I'm guessing the market will probably put them back up at minus 150, that type of range. Yeah. But the Bucks, they were 7-point favorites against the Clippers, and they really could have lost that game. I mean, that game was tied late in the fourth. They ultimately pull it out just because the Clippers were relying on Terrence Mann and Amir Coffey to create offense. But what do you think ultimately of this race, which is effectively the two seed market?
Yeah, I think they're going to reopen this minus 200, Jay. Sorry. I don't think minus 150 is going to be available for the Bucks, because this today's sun, we are in the immediate afterglow or aftermath of this. These two results were huge. The Cavs blowing a home game against the Nets in their current state was a little inexcusable, and they're beat up, right? Donovan Mitchell, we're not expecting to see him again until later this week, if not next weekend. And you know, this is a team that just in general has been trying to figure themselves out as they have kind of been shuffling through these lineup combinations. And they don't have any easy outs next to, you know, Monday. If you're listening to this on Monday, they're playing the Phoenix Suns, and the Phoenix Suns will have Devin Booker back. Good luck to the, you know, Cavaliers bouncing back from this tough loss against the Nets when you're going up against the full strength Suns team. I think there is a very realistic likelihood here that the Cavs capitulate here in the next week, and that this market is a runaway. So I think the game for the Bucks beating the Clippers was obviously less, I think, telling. You didn't have a full strength Clippers team to really kind of say that the Bucks have quote unquote figured it out. But you know, the Bucks at least are kind of approaching full strength, and you know, they're now in the phase where Doc Rivers knows what he has to work with, and he's got these guys playing better regular season basketball than they were playing in the previous stretch when he immediately took over, and they're playing in the stretch when you know, before Adrian Griffin was fired. So I think ultimately the Bucks kind of performing at a level that gets them into the two seed free and clear, I think, is a fair expectation. And I think the market is going to react pretty aggressively to these particular results, I think, and really what is expected with Cleveland tomorrow, because Cleveland drops that game to the Suns. All of a sudden, this is now like, well, now they have ground to make up. They're not healthy, and the Bucks are playing better. I think, you know, this is probably your last chance to unload anything on Bucks if you're holding a massive ticket on Cavs.
Yeah, I think, the Bucks should certainly be clear favorites. The only thing is that, so Cleveland looks like they will have the tie break in this one, which is helpful, and Mitchell and Mobley will come back. Their schedule the rest of the way is not super difficult. These next couple of games, Phoenix, New Orleans, but at Houston, Şengün likely won't be a part of that. I think almost certainly won't be a part of that. The Pacers scuffling, the Heat, who just lost to the Wizards. They get the Wolves without Cat, and then it's like Charlotte, Philly, and then it gets a little bit harder towards the end. But I think if you're looking to fade the idea of the Bucks running away with this, it's just that the Bucks aren't very good, I don't think. A week ago, there was the idea that, and it was all sweltering on Twitter, and people are so desperate for the Celtics not to make the finals. And there was the idea, oh, the Bucks, they're finally the team that we thought they were going to be entering the season. Nah, I don't think so. Like, they lost to the Warriors by 35. And then they lost to the Lakers without LeBron. And then they very nearly lost to the Amir Coffee led Los Angeles Clippers. So I don't think the Bucks are fixed. I do think that they are better under Doc. And I think a lot of that was just they couldn't get any worse under Griffin. I think Pat Beverley has helped them. Middleton coming back is going to help a lot. But at the same time, like, I don't really see, I mean, this team clearly has a ceiling, but I don't think they have a ceiling that really beats a healthy Boston unless there is, like, you know, Miami level three point type variance. So I think they've established themselves as the second best team in the East, though. And with the Cavs, a couple of weeks ago, or maybe 3 weeks ago, I was thinking that maybe the Cavs just are this absolute juggernaut. And they had the second best net rating in the East. They're on that insane run. Mobley looked like he had taken a step. Donovan Mitchell was playing at a level basically commensurate to Jason Tatum's level. The depth with the Okoro rising up, Strus gave them an extra dimension that was feeling like the Chetty Osman role last year. Caris LeVert is a good, complicated basketball man, but if he's your sixth, seventh best player, that is fine. But just having watched a lot, this team's been on national television a lot lately, for better or worse.
Yeah, and it's just not for better.
It's not pretty. It's the I was very impressed. Well, not impressed necessarily, but I was very captivated by the almost Naz Reid game on national TV.
Yeah,
the other night, but it wasn't good basketball. And no. Jared Allen has definitely gotten a lot better, but Garland hasn't. And I think a lot of that is the fact that, you know, you forget this, but when you have a broken jaw, you can't eat food for a month. And he just looks like he didn't eat food for a month. He just doesn't look like he's right and all the way back. And he's not going to the rim as much or being as effective, probably because he wasn't able to eat food for a month. And he's probably still coming back conditioning wise. So they just seem a little bit all over the place. They're not going to have that much time to click into place. in terms of getting healthy and then just figuring out like Mobley Allen together with Mitchell Garland together. They have these two awkward overlapping things at the two positions or two areas at guard and center effectively that, you know, it's not as easy to have those overlaps as it is at wing. So do you think there's any ceiling for the Cavs to make the Eastern Conference Finals or even trouble Celtics?
Yeah, I mean, you know, if they have to go through the Bucks on the road, I feel less good, obviously. You know, if they draw the Heat in a 3-6, I feel less good about them even getting to round two. And I think your point about Garland is very fair. The more he, you know, the more minutes he gets on the court, I think he plays himself into shape. He'll be more like the guy that we remember from the early portion of the season than the guy we're seeing now. And Mitchell is, as you know, he's taken a meaningful step forward. This is not just he played great around the All-Star break. Like he is playing better like than he was as a, you know, his previous iteration with the Jazz. And I think that that definitely matters. So, you know, there's scope for the Cavs still to be a problem. Their closing five, I think, is very dynamic. It's very exciting. The winning they had against the Mavericks, remember that one with Max Strus going absolutely nuclear and hitting that miracle three. There were some high points from the Cavs in that game where you were like, okay, like this team can fight. They can fight through a playoff, you know, adversity in the playoffs, and you were starting to feel better about them. But I will say that the key to being sort of the second choice in the East, which is really what we're talking about between the Bucks and the Cavs, is that the Bucks really needed to not figure it out. And what you're seeing from Giannis right now is just special. Like he's performing at a level that is just. I don't remember seeing it in his career to this point. I didn't know he had this gear offensively, frankly. And it has nothing to do with who he's out there playing with. Like it is simply just how he is playing basketball from what I can tell you. Maybe there is some spacing things that are too tough for me to discern because I just don't really understand basketball as well as the, you know, the top, you know, end boss guys. But you know, there's been huge stretches here where Lillard has played very poorly and like, you're like, man, is he broken? Is he on the decline? Like, is it over? Like the amount that he had dropped from first couple of, you know, first stretch of the season to now is meaningful. And I, you know, there's, you know, some people who could read into that as just like, hey, he's cooked, like it's over. You know, it's yeah, but you know, we shouldn't have expected it was going to be immediate for a guy like Lillard, who is, you know, kind of the central engine of an offense on a bad team with the Blazers, to become, you know, an effective second banana after Giannis with the Bucks. And they are starting to show you signs that they're figuring it out, which I think is important for a playoff expectation and really kind of just, you know, like actually realizing their potential as the clear second best team in the East. So I'm not scared of the Bucks right now as a Celtics backer in any way, shape, or form. There are still clear and obvious structural failures for them defensively at point of attack that, you know, tend to be your Achilles heel in the end of a series that's close. So the Bucks could get beat by the likes of the Cavs, even in a 2-3, you know, series that's closely contested. But the fact that Lillard seems to be physically fine today kind of was a little bit of a proof of concept in that. Actually, even the last game where he was started out so against the Lakers, he was useless, miserable in that first quarter. And it was like, why is he even playing? Like, this guy's not right. Like, clearly, like, what is happening here? He played through whatever, you know, kind of rust he needed to shake off. He was excellent after that. And then today he was spectacular. So, if he is that kind of Robin to Giannis's Batman, then, you know, you have a 1-2 punch that can definitely get you to the Eastern Conference Finals. Now, can that get you more than one or two wins against the Celtics? It remains to be seen. I think Bucks are right now, at least pretty clearly, ought to be rated your number two team in the East until we know if and when we see Joel Embiid back again.
Yep. On Giannis, I mean, I think you could make a pretty strong case that this is the best offensive season of his career defensively as well. He's not quite at the 19-20 level when he won DPOY, but he's a lot better than he was the past couple of years by the advanced defensive stats there. And the thing last year where, you know, he was, I think, pretty firmly in the mix for MVP in the last couple of weeks of the season, and I will go to my grave thinking that, you know, he had this Well, he had these two games in three nights. I think it was like a Friday and a Sunday night on the penultimate weekend of the season where he played Boston and Philly. And I thought that if he swept those two, that he would have won MVP. And he beat Embiid on the Sunday, but he lost by 40 at home to the Celtics. It was like 2.5 point favorites on the Friday. I think that really sunk him. And then, you know, you'd probably need Embiid not scoring 50-plus against the Celtics the following week. But I think it was a real path for him to actually win the award. And he wouldn't have come close to deserving it, even though I backed him and thought that voters would skew that way if he did that double. But he has gotten significantly better. He's just shooting better from everywhere. Like, he's shooting 83% at the rim. And he takes over 50% of his field goal attempts at the rim. From floater range, last year he shot 35%. This year he shoots 45%, and he takes 25% of his shots from floater range. Like, that's insane. Yeah. And then mid-range, he's at 37% after being 35% on long twos. And then he's shooting 30% from three as well, which is, you know, not good, but that's the best he's shot in the past 3 years. So he is at another level. It's just the perimeter. I mean, they're guarding, I know that James Harden isn't James Harden anymore, but like Malik Beasley is their wing stopper on James Harden on Sunday. And there's just nothing there. And I think ripples into the rest of the team. Just last thing on the Bucks, and we'll talk about other award markets through the week. I have a lot of strong feelings about most improved player. And we'll get to that at some point. But just quickly, sixth man of the year. Bobby Portis, his price has caved from like 125 to 1 into 9 to 1, 10 to 1 the past week or so. I would be stunned if Portis wins sixth man of the year, where I don't think you put a line through him. I don't think it's impossible. I think he's like the way I price the market, he's a 3% chance to win the award the way I do it. But the problem with Portis is that he just has no superlatives in the race. Like, he's not the best at anything of the any candidates. He's not even really in the top two for anything, for any candidates, like in terms of scoring, playmaking, advanced stats, defense, the team success he's getting there now that Minnesota and the Clippers have fallen off. But, I mean, they're not going to be a one seed. They're going to finish 10 games behind Boston, and they're not going to be significantly stratified from the Wolves and the Clippers, I think. So, like, he's averaging 13 and 7 on worse efficiency than Reed and Powell. His team is kind of weird. The Bucks are like 7 points per 100 better when he's on the bench. I would be very surprised if Portis wins this award. But what do you think?
No, I don't know. It would hey, if you got on at 120, good bet.
Yeah, I think it's a good bet. Yeah, I still think it's a good bet.
At 10 to 1, not interested. And I think ultimately, the cases for some of the kind of more traditional challengers, namely Naz Reid and Norm Powell, I think are better. But sixth man is going to be just an absolute joke of, kind of, fair prediction, whatever team puts together the best campaign for their sixth man who finishes in, top three seeding is probably going to win it. Because that's kind of it, like, that's how like fragile the winds of opinion are right now for this award. Because it's not going to Monk. Like, Sacramento.
Wait, sure. Monk, I think it's not happening.
It's not happening, man. It's not happening. The Kings continue to hurt themselves, even in when everyone else is trying to guarantee them a playoff spot. They continue to take themselves down a peg or two. So I think ultimately, if the Kings are in the play-in situation, people are going to pass over Monk for that reason specifically, or they're just going to down ballot him. Somebody is live to be campaigned. Clippers, start making some public. I know the Clippers lost today, but Norm Powell had 26 points, Jay. Yeah, people should know about that. They should hear about that. He stepped in and really tried to provide a huge amount of pump pop for those. Hey, Karl Anthony Towns, he got hurt, man. Naz Reid, he stepped right in, and this team is still going to get a top three seed in the West. They are not going to fall into the four. Like if that ultimately happens and the team kind of really does a good job PR-wise, I think that could be enough to flip it.
Yep. No, I think it's possible. I think the issue is like, we talk about and I'm guilty of it too, we talk about, if Monk falls into the play-in, like normally when we're talking about the play-in, it's like teams that win like 38 games or whatever, like the Hawks, whatever, the Lakers and the Warriors will be probably just slightly above 500. Like the Kings are probably going to be like 47 and 35. Like it's a real record, unfortunately. And I think that is ultimately what is going to get Monk home, that he's on a high 40s team and he's got the best stats. And you know, he has these moments, like he scores 39 against Minnesota. But I don't think he is infallible. And if they do slide a bit and they're like an 8 seed and Minnesota or the Clippers take off, then I do think that he can be gotten. I think that the key thing in the race is that Westbrook and Kat both going down. Like Norm Powell just closes every game now for the Clippers. And I think the key to me is it's not so much the stratification of seed. It's the fact that if you poll every voter on who the best teams in the West are, I think pretty much every one of them would tell you that Sacramento are 10th. They're the 10th best team in the West. No one thinks that they're better or more of a chance to win than I think any other team that is going to be in the playoff to play in mix. And Norm Powell plays on the team that is the third favorite for the title. And he's just more important to the season than Malik Monk is going to be. Nazari doesn't feel quite as important to the season, but he's still on a team that's, you know,
to the people who pay attention, he does, Jay.
Hoopers love Naz. And the thing is there is that, so like we're recording just as Naz is about to tip against the Lakers. So maybe he has 2 points tonight, maybe he has 50, we don't know. But he is with Kat down, he is the second highest usage player
on
the Minnesota Timberwolves. He had 31% usage against the Cavs. That's like what Giannis does. Like, that's more usage than Jokic. Jokic is like 28-29% usage on the season. So I think he's going to take a ton of shots. He's going to have to play more because no one else can do anything on the team outside of Ant on offense. So I think that he has a path. I think Powell has a path. But unfortunately, I think Monk is up. He most likely winner.
Okay. But Portis, we agree, is very clearly fourth tier.
He's the Caris LeVert land, which is a barren land with very little water. And
he'll finish ahead of Tim Hardaway Jr., so you got that going for you if you bet.
Yeah, I think he's well put for us to win. Just don't think he's 10% with like the market's implying.
Right.
All right, spring training is here. So for those looking to get ahead on the upcoming MLB season, grab your RotoWorld Baseball Draft Guide. It's loaded with comprehensive positional rankings, projections, and player profiles to ensure your draft is a success. Visit nbcsports.com/draftguide and use code baseball24 to get 10% off at checkout. Let's talk about MVP, given that we are talking about awards, and this is obviously the one that gets the most press. Big surge towards Jokic since the All-Star break, which he has been no small part of, given that he has played very much like the best player in the world. He's had these massive marquee wins. He had the, 32-16-16 against the Warriors on national TV. He takes down the Celtics and has that phenomenal lob pass to Aaron Gordon to almost wrap it up. Though, you know, we didn't do a show together last week to talk about that game, but like the Celtics, everyone came out of that game being like, oh, the Nuggets, like they're right there with the Celtics, and the Celtics are really going to struggle if they see them in the finals. I came out of that game thinking that the Nuggets shot 60% from mid-range, 96% from the line. Jaylen Brown turned into DeAndre Jordan from the free throw line. And Jason Tatum had a wide open three to take the lead with 40 seconds left. But anyway, with MVP, Jokic now minus 190, Shea Gilgeous-Alexander plus 265. And I think that's all that matters. I think Luka Doncic is dead. You can put a line through him. I think Giannis is the third most likely player to win. I also think at this point he is, unfortunately, for my position on Giannis, pretty close to a rounding error. I think this is a two-horse race. Looks like the market has shifted slightly since we put together the rundown. Jokic minus 175, Shea plus 260. What are your thoughts on the market at the moment?
I have to throw the white flag of defeat here. Backing Shea. I know that I would like to hear your impassioned case as to why I should not throw in the towel and just unload everything I can on Nikola Jokic and just get out of this. The problem here is that the Nuggets were scuffling on the way into the All-Star break, and they came out with purpose. And they have delivered high-profile wins. in a time of year where people are really, really chewing hard on the idea of who should be MVP. And he is accumulating just a massive amount of support from talking heads and talking heads who matter. The Zach Lowe's of the world don't even really see this as a true debate anymore. It's like, yeah, Jokic is number one with bullet and Shea's probably number two. Like, that's the problem. The kind of accentuating of the problem is that in order for Shea to win this award, I thought that the Thunder, and at the time I made these bets, I was like, man, the Thunder have a very realistic likelihood of having a margin over the Nuggets for the one seed in the West. And it's not looking like that right now, because the 3-4 in the West in the Timberwolves and the Clippers have taken a notable step backward, which means the Nuggets are going to be a top two seed. If they're the one seed, then forget about it. It's over. He's winning 98 out of 100 votes. Like, it's not even, don't even count them. Right. If they're the two seed, then he's still probably winning, but it's not a runaway. What I think needed to happen really was OKC to get the one, Shea to start getting the realistic credit for he is the reason why, which he is a huge reason why, and the Nuggets kind of falling into sort of behind the Timberwolves, maybe even behind the Clippers in the four seed in the West. And at that point, you're like, you're really going to give it to a guy who got his team to a four seed over Shea, who elevated a Thunder team that didn't make the playoffs last year to the one. And in that light, it was pretty obvious to see Shea flipping him. In the current light, if it's even in the best case scenario where it is Shea ekes out the Nuggets for the one seed, I still think it's going to be tough for him to flip Jokic for MVP. My current projections have this neck and neck, who even gets the one seed. So that's kind of why I'm just ready to pull the ripcord on this. Do you see anything that I'm not seeing here that says Shea has it better than what is it implied right now? Something like a 28% chance?
I think that is about fair. On Shea, like that type of range at the moment. And I think that, look, the reason that I was so bullish on Shea in the All-Star break basically is that Jokic was coming off these three losses in a row where they got lost by 29 Sacramento, got blown out by Giannis in Milwaukee. And then the last game before the All-Star break, he was 6 of 17 and scored 15 points and a loss at home to the Kings. And it just felt like the Nuggets weren't going to rev it up to the degree that they had. And so I thought that if just the status quo endured and Shea finished, two, three games in front of Jokic, Jokic kind of just kept on doing his thing, which his thing had kind of become averaging, he averaged 26.6 points in January and 11.5 rebounds, 8.5 assists. I thought if that held, that Shea would win. But the problem is with that is that Jokic has just come out like a man possessed, and he's done it in these incredibly high-profile games. It is incredible the difference in his, I think, just his scoring mentality in big games as opposed to not big games. Like, for instance, against Sacramento at the end of February, he took 9 field goals for the game. I think against the Lakers, he might have, a couple of days after that, he might have taken 11 in the first quarter. And that is kind of, it's a testament to him that, and you saw it in the playoffs, like when he needs to score, he has that extra gear. And that gear has just been on full display after the All-Star break. So my thing with MVP is that this award has always been on Jokic's racket because he is the best player. He has the highest pedigree. He is the guy that voters hold in the highest regard of anyone. And if he just plays up to his level, then he was always going to win. I just didn't think that he would play up to this level consistently during the regular season. But it seems like the Nuggets, they really want to get the one seed or at least get the top two seed. And with that, Jokic is just playing insanely well. And look, if Jokic, has it been 8 games out of the All-Star break? 8-9 games. If he replicates that form the rest of the way, then it's over. Like, Shea's just not going to win. But the thing is, and why I don't think it's done, is that at any moment, Jokic could just take the foot off the gas a little bit. If they have a mini, if they have a two-game losing streak and all of a sudden they're three back of OKC and the tiebreak, which OKC have already secured against Denver effectively with the division record, then all of a sudden it's like, oh, well, is Jokic just going to go into December mode where he averaged 22.7 points per game for an entire month? Because if that happens and Shea gets the one seed and continues to play as he always does, and he just always does the same thing. It's like he scores between 28 and 39 points every single game. Yeah. He didn't have a big scoring night against Memphis tonight, but he was plus 29, and the game was done after the first quarter and a bit. So yeah. I don't think this is wrapped. I think that with these awards, and this is something that I've gotten better at over time, is that, you know, when we see a game like Denver-Boston and the way that Jokic played, it's like, oh, it's done. It's all over. Like, Jokic won the MVP that night. Like, really? He won MVP in a one regular season game out of 82 that, yes, was nationally televised, but came on March 7th. And at that point, I think he was in a three seed. Like, it's not done. It shifts win equity. Like, he might have added, like, 5 to 6% win equity for MVP in that game, but it's the same with like six man of the year. Like, oh, Malik Monk scores 39 against Minnesota. Oh, it's done. Well, he, like, a week later, he loses to Houston at home. It's a 7-point favorite. Like, it's not, it's very rarely done. The only times that it is when Embiid scores 50 against Boston in the last week of the season. And then it's actually done. But I think that there is still time. Like, we've got not quite a quarter of the season left, but 18 games or whatever. There is still time for another twist. But if the status quo holds, then I think Jokic will win somewhat comfortably, because the thing, it's, to me, it's a really interesting race from a psychological perspective, where I think that people are so guilty about how last year's race unfolded and the way that Jokic was weirdly kind of like demonized in the race. It's like, how can you vote for this guy when, for a third MVP, when he hasn't even made the finals? And then the fact that Embiid just was so bad in the playoffs and didn't show up at all in game 7 against Boston. And then Jokic was like 100th percentile for meeting expectations. And everyone's like, oh no, what did I do with my vote? Yeah. And I think there is that aspect that is, I'm not saying Jokic is undeserving at all. I would vote for Jokic today, I think.
He
I think
probably is the most important.
Well, he's the best player. And if he keeps playing like this, then he will win and he should win. But I just think the fact that he has shown he can take the foot off the gas, that opens it up a little bit, but it's going to take a couple of losses and the one seed getting further away. But I do think more than most, like, Giannis will never take his foot off the gas, whatever happens. Like, Jokic, if he's all of a sudden, like, the one seed is no longer in play, I think he is more likely to let go of the rope than perhaps other players like Giannis or Luka might be if they were the threat to Shea.
Yeah, that's totally fair. I feel like, again, like, one of the reasons that I feel like waving the white flag right now, I feel like the bet at the All-Star break was coin flip, that the Nuggets were going to, like, literally come out of the break and be focused and double down and win that stretch of games. Everyone, you know, not slip during the games that were winnable and really be, like, clearly dialed into the games that were coin flip. And, you know, so you're kind of like, yeah, this is 50-50. Like, maybe they coast. Right? Yeah, they can coast. What do they need to, you know, press for? Should they press? Right? Like, these were questions that we were having at the All-Star break, and they pressed and they did well and they won every freaking high leverage game. And the fact that, like, a game like the Celtics was clearly, like, I think everybody who, like, follows NBA closely will tune into that one and was like, finals preview, let's go. Like, this is it. Right. And we come out of that game the next day. Zach Lowe spent, what, 30 minutes, like, really just breaking down that game and how important it was and what happened. And five times during his breakdown is like, yeah, Jokic is clearly the MVP. Jokic is clearly the MVP. Tatum MVP was never even real. It's definitely dead now. You know, like that was like the whole kind of subtext to the conversation about that game. Like, that echoes phenomenally, you know, success, you know, effectively around the, you know, the think hive of the people who are in the voting block. So I kind of think it's done. And, like, this is not a strong opinion at all. This is a very weak sauce. But The Thunder have been playing well too. Like, and like, they're not getting credit for it. Like, they're getting ignored because they're not in as high profile of games. Like, they're keeping pace for the most part, other than the one slip they had against the Lakers. And because it was against the Lakers, it got covered as if they were in some kind of a tailspin. And you're like, the Thunder are playing amazingly well right now. Like, they just caught the Lakers on the wrong night. Like, good Lord. And you felt like people, you know, kind of came out of that like the sky was falling for them. And it was not good. And I honestly think the fact that March Madness is coming up is bad for SGA, because if the Nuggets take their foot off the gas during March Madness, and March Madness happens to be sucking the air out of the room on ESPN instead of, you know, like actual coverage of the NBA, then, you know, Jokic could find some cover. But feels like he wants to win this. It feels like your points specifically about how the voting went last year, like, that was my thesis coming into this season. I bet a ton of Jokic early, but I dumped it all for SGA because I thought the price was wrong. And now I'm ready to just get back out of this market.
Yeah, I think the thing is with this, how it fluctuates. Like, on Thursday night, Shea plays national TV on TNT against Luka in OKC. Like, if Shea goes for 42 in that game or whatever, then all of a sudden, like, it's a race again. He plays at Milwaukee in a couple of weeks. If he beats Giannis, like, it does change and it fluctuates, and something can feel done. But then it's like, oh, well, the other guy just scored 40 on national TV. Not done anymore. It's undone. But I definitely get the point. I think Jokic is very much on the path. And if I had my time over in terms of handicapping this, I think what I probably should have paid more attention to is how much Malone tightened his rotation and really went for the games in January against Boston and Milwaukee. And Jokic took 47 field goal attempts across those two games. And I was thinking, like, oh, well, those are just two, you know, isolated games against Boston and Milwaukee, potentially two of the top three, four teams in the NBA. And I thought that those were going to be more isolated. But it's like, no, it's like he's doing this like every single game against any opponent of note. And if it's on national TV, then he's absolutely doing it. But I mean, as done as it feels, like, what, we're three games removed from Jokic having 7 turnovers and 5 assists and having a really bad game against Phoenix on national TV. So
sure,
it can change. But it certainly feels like he's on the path. Also, last thing.
Yeah,
I love Zach Lowe. Few do a better job than him in his area. He also did go on NBA TV in mid-March last year and declare that Sixth Man of the Year was completely over on a segment with Richard Jefferson and Malika Andrews, and said that Emmanuel Quickley had already wrapped it up, and it didn't work out that way, much to my chagrin. So sometimes we can.
Okay. So here's what we need. You ready?
Yeah.
We need OKC to be the one seed by at least 2 games. Okay. It can't be tiebreak. No. One seed. they gotta be clearly the one seed. And you know what's gotta happen is they gotta have the lead by 2 games when the second and third place teams, the Nuggets and the Timberwolves, face off in late April, or sorry, mid-April, I guess, April 10th, right? We need Rudy Gobert, our defensive player of the year hero. We need him to just smother. We just need to make Rudy make Jokic look pedestrian in that game where the Nuggets need it for the one and Jokic doesn't deliver. If that happens, and you know, the other kind of stuff we're talking about of SGA showing up in these big games against the likes of Dallas and Milwaukee and just in general, like running away with the one seed, like, and is that even going to happen if Jalen Williams misses a couple of games here? Like all kinds of moving parts here right now that are kind of keeping me a little bit awake at night. That, you know, I think it's getting long odds, and the 28% chance feels about right, if not a little optimistic.
Yep, I think it's about right. All right, well, let's talk about the one seed market. But first, this weekend, the best on the PGA Tour head home to take on TPC Sawgrass for the 50th time for the Players' Championship. Don't miss the best golfers in the world Thursday through Sunday on NBC Golf Channel and all-round streaming on Peacock. Comcast Business is a proud partner of the Players' Championship in addition to Optum and Morgan Stanley. And I will be part of the coverage, Drew, on Golf Channel Wednesday through Sunday, each morning with my good friend George Savarikas. So tune in for that. One seed market, and I agree with everything you said. I think in terms of like Jokic MVP, Denver one seed, like now is kind of the pivotal stretch. And unfortunately now for Denver starts with a home game against Toronto. So it's not really now. It's a delayed now. But after that, they go at Miami, national TV, ESPN, Wednesday night, home San Antonio, at Dallas, at Minnesota, home New York. So that's like a real stretch of games. So, and with the Toronto game, like I think you need something mainly for MVP, and obviously it ripples into the one seed market, is like you need the Nuggets to somehow go like 3-3 in that stretch, while OKC, who are an incredibly soft part of their schedule at the moment, OKC go 5-1, which is very doable even without Jalen Williams, because they're playing teams like the Grizzlies again. And if that happens and Shai is three games clear, then at that point, I think maybe you start to see a letting go of the rope. And so I still think, and we've got to see how serious the Jalen Williams thing is, because if he's out for a while, then they're in big trouble. But I still think this is pretty close to a coin flip, because OKC, they have the easiest schedule, they have the tiebreak, and they're a game up. So even if you think that Denver are the better team, like there are a lot of equalizing factors there. So I think this is pretty close to a coin flip. I think the problem for Oklahoma City in a way is that this Cat injury for Minnesota, and people pile on Cat. Like Cat is a fantastic player and he is one of the best offensive big men that we've ever seen, as he'll tell you himself, the greatest offensive big man shooter of all time, though Dirk Nowitzki arguably made shots that mattered and Cat hasn't. But his absence is significant. And yeah, there's the idea that, oh, well, they have Rudy Gobert who plays center. And so there's positional overlap already. And Naz Reid is a really good backup big. And he is. The problem is what we were talking about before, Naz Reid has the second highest usage on the team. Like, they need a Cat, because only he and Ant are the only guys who can really do that much on offense efficiently. So yeah, it helps that you've got Rudy and Naz, and Slow-Mo can play more minutes at the four, but like Slow-Mo's atrocious on offense and they really need Cat to be an elite team. I think without Cat, they become like, I don't know, are they worse than the Kings? Like, do they become the 10th best team in the West, thereabouts? Like, not far off it. And so the problem is for the Thunder is that the Wolves still have three games against the Nuggets, which I think you might have mentioned before. And so that is ill-timed for Shai and for the Thunder. But at the same time, I think this is basically a coin flip market.
I agree. And ultimately, the fundamental, you know, how do we deal with the injury question marks for both of the other teams besides the Nuggets is key here. I rewatched the Jalen Williams injury a couple times. Let it be known, I feel strongly that he is the second most important player on the Thunder. And I think his absence is meaningful. You cannot replace those minutes effectively with who they have available the same way you could if it was a shooting guard or a small forward. And so their defense is going to struggle, I think, a little bit. Like, they succeed because of what Jalen Williams can do defensively in combination with being able to get away with effectively having Chet out there as a stretch. And I think it's potentially problematic for them, considering their upcoming schedule has a couple of really high profile games. If he misses 2 to 4, maybe it's not as big of a deal, but if he misses 2 to 4 weeks, then we're talking OKC is pretty much out of the mix for the one seed, I think. The Timberwolves, I think you've kind of nailed this. The fact that Cat goes down now before they have three games against the Nuggets really does tilt this pretty aggressively. You have Timberwolves only really have, as far as I can count, five games that they realistically should still win in the absence of Cat, and then they have another five that are true blue coin flips. And then the rest of the games, they're going to be long shots here, which is about eight games. It's not good. So I think the Timberwolves are out of the mix. I think the Nuggets are in, you know, prime position, assuming they stay healthy. But that said, like, there's, you know, the injury bug is going around right now. Like, pretty clearly, the emphasis of getting players on the court by the NBA is, it's having some impact. I have to assume that that's part of this, right? Like, what, in the last 3 weeks, we've seen, like, meaningful injuries across so many teams and at so many high levels. I can't imagine that this is not in some way related to an effort to get the players on court more often. But that said, it's been the best regular season in terms of watching basketball. So I appreciate that they're doing this. And, you know, I think ultimately this is probably just a little bit of a gamble on who stays healthy between OKC and Denver. And Denver, I think, has the inside track. I would make them 45% to OKC's 55% to OKC's 45 if you put them head to head, just considering schedule and the impact of the Jalen Williams injury. And yeah, I mean, if Minnesota was fully healthy, I was ready to pound the table and say these guys are the ones that are going to get it there, because I thought their offense was good enough, and the defense is something that is, you know, is been so you know, repeatable even against the high level teams all season for them. It really is a shame that they now are going to be, you know, forced to win games 106 to 105. But I don't see their offense all of a sudden improving. So yeah, tough break for the Timberwolves, not even considering the Clippers at this point. The Clippers look very content to just kind of tread water and, you know, take a top four seed at, you know, from what we can tell, although the Pelicans are knocking on the door. So we'll see if they change their tune a bit, but yeah, to me, it looks like the Nuggets probably should be the clear favorite here, and the Thunder just behind them. If the Timberwolves manage to hang in here, considering their schedule, then all the power to them, but it's not something I'm betting on.
Yeah, I think that if you're pro Timberwolves in terms of their chances, the main thing is that there's only 18 games left, and it takes not, like, you can luck box two extra wins just with random variance. And even if you're playing at the level of a 10-8 team, it doesn't take that much to go from 10-8 to 12-6 with just a couple of shots falling. And so I don't think that it's that dire for them because of that. But at the same time, I think they're very likely your three seed at the moment. And this Timberwolves team is just, I'm glad that I don't have like a massive position on anything Timberwolves related. I've largely been against them in the division market outside of Gobert, DPOY, which I'm still like, this 65 game thing just really makes a man stressed, where he's been sitting at 60, he's sitting at 62. He's missing this game against the Lakers. Yeah. Like, it's going to be fine probably, but I just want him to play the 65th game. Can you just get to 20 minutes in the 65th game, Rudy? And then I don't have to watch Timberwolves basketball anymore. I thought, like, I'm getting paranoid about, like, when he does the money sign, it's like, is he going to get suspended for this? Is they going to make an example of him? And now he's got this, like, hamstring tightness. We just played the 65th game, Rudy. Stop doing dumb stuff. This team is so dumb. It's unbelievable. I watched a lot of T-Wolves this year, and between the decisions that Ant makes at the end of games. Like,
that was a nice block.
Oh, it's a great block. He's a great player. But the fact in the Clippers game that they were down three and he dunked with 3 seconds left. Like, I'm sorry, I don't care if the play breaks out like that. You just need to have some sense at that point. And that was the most Wolvesy thing ever. Cat just loves burrowing into four dudes and just throwing the ball out of bounds. Yeah. Rudy is a genius on defense and an anti-genius on offense, and a really tough person to root for. And I will gladly collect my money on Rudy Gobert, Defensive Player of the Year. But it's not something I really want to celebrate, because I feel like it's blood money because of just the dumb stuff that guy does.
Dude, we need him to show up three more times, man, against the Nuggets.
Like, three games, Rudy, for the love of God. It's a little macabre. He's at the point now where if he has a season-ending injury, he still qualifies for the award, and I think he'd still win. But just play the 65th game.
Yeah.
And just lastly, before we sign off, the idea that, so here's what he does. He airballs a wide open dunk against Jared Allen.
Yep.
He like elbows Jared Allen in like the face or something. It's a flagrant foul. So yeah, an elbow is a flagrant, Rudy. And then he commits a foul at the end. And then he gets a tech foul for suggesting to the referee that they're on the take. Like, you don't think any of that was justified, Rudy? You think the only way this can be explained is that referees are betting against you? This is the most inane stuff. How about you say this after a game you win? Say it after a game you win. Then you'll actually have some credibility. Like, it is just the most adolescent take. And the fact that there have to be articles written about this is an absolute disgrace, Drew. And, yeah, I'm ready to move on from cheering for this bloke.
Yeah, and not great that he did all this in the shadow of – or was shadow the precursor of playing the Lakers, who are kind of the quintessential most effective at manipulating the refs into calling things correctly. Like, they're not getting, you know, kind of BS calls here. Like, they're just drawing contact and forcing the refs to call it like they're supposed to. And yeah, to stick your finger in the eye of the refs on the eve of a Lakers game was especially dumb, I thought.
Yeah, there is a great piece of my heart that is so thankful that my biggest ever win on any of these markets was Marcus Smart at 500-1 taking down
him down.
And it was such a pleasure cheering against that guy every single night and just turning on Jazz games and being like, oh, the Clippers came back from 26 and Paul George is lighting up Rudy on switches. This is magnificent. It's financially beneficial and spiritually beneficial.
People forgot Rudy Gobert was singularly responsible for the pandemic.
Yeah, exactly. And the best part is that I think if I had a vote that year, I would have voted Gobert. I think he was the most deserving candidate.
Without question. Without question. You're saying the Marcus Smart year, right?
Yeah. It should have been really
I agree. I agree with that.
And Marcus got it done, much to my delight. All right. We are done. Don't forget to check out NBCSports.com for more information to help you with your wagers. Thanks to those watching on the NBC Sports YouTube channel. If you're listening to us in podcast form, don't forget to rate and subscribe. Also a reminder to find all your favorite NBC Sports shows on Amazon Music. Just head to amazon.com/NBC Sports. From Jay Croucher and Drew Dinsick, we'll see you tomorrow.